This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 2012 and this year, Vermont Legal Aid has conducted studies looking into discriminatory practices in Vermont's rental housing market. The results of this year's study show a depressing reality. In almost half of the test cases, there was some incidence of discrimination. We're going to talk about how best to deal with these issues from the renter's perspective and from the landlord's in just a moment. But first, let's get the details on this new study. Rachel Batterson is the Housing Discrimination Law Project Director for Vermont Legal Aid. Rachel, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So in Vermont, it is illegal or unlawful to discriminate in housing on the basis of race, color, national origin, religion, sex, disability, the presence of minor children, marital status, sexual orientation, age, gender identity, or the receipt of public assistance, including rental subsidies. So what you're finding is that in many of these categories, there remains or appears to be widespread discrimination. What are your statistics?
So Vermont Legal Aid does housing discrimination testing. We represent individuals and groups in housing discrimination cases, and we advocate for inclusive communities through land use planning. Our most recent testing findings that we just published in this report found an overall discrimination rate of 44%, with a 46% discrimination rate against people with foreign or Hispanic accents, 35% discrimination based on race, color, and 45% discrimination against families with children.
So what does discrimination actually look like? Are we talking about people not getting apartments or what?
These tests primarily tested the application stage. So yes, these would be circumstances where someone was applying for an apartment and didn't get it.
And what is the discrimination from the landlord actually, what form does that come in?
Well, we like to talk about how discrimination often comes in the form of with a handshake and a smile. What that means is the person experiencing the discrimination doesn't actually know that it happened. And that's not because the discrimination is not subtle. It's actually very overt. The problem is that you wouldn't know as the person applying that it happened unless you compared your experience to another person to essentially a control. So, for example, if I was a woman with children applying for an apartment and I called and I was told, I'm sorry, that apartment has already been rented. That would be the end of my experience. When we do testing, we follow up that call with a call from a woman saying, I don't have any children. And that person is told, that apartment is vacant, please come over and look at it, and is generally encouraged to apply. So we know from that interaction by comparing the two that, in fact, that was a lie, that the apartment was not available.
So beyond an apartment not being available, what are other situations that people might encounter?
So sometimes, especially with the national origin or accented people calling, the person with the accent just won't get a callback. And all of the white testers that are the control will get callbacks. Or the callback will be made first to the white callers who actually called second, and then hours or days later, the people with accents will be called back.
So remind me again how you do the testing. You have a control subject, you have testers who come in who are doing calls or site visits. So explain how it works.
Sure. So testing uses matched pairs. So for example, if we were going to test on the basis of discrimination based on race, color, we might use an African-American man and a white man, and we would match those testers as much as possible in terms of their age, their dress, their personality, and then they would apply for the same housing opportunity. Then they would come back and tell us what their experience was, and we would compare those results. Now, those two testers never meet each other and don't know that they're each testing, so the only people seeing the comparison is us.
And you did this throughout Vermont. Burlington is obviously the largest market, but you're doing it throughout the state?
We're doing testing throughout the state. The linguistic profiling, which is the large telephone test with the people with foreign or Hispanic accents, that is mostly the Burlington area because that's where most of the rental housing is.
So Vermont Legal Aid issued a similar report in 2012 that had come out of the same type of testing, and you found much the same thing. We haven't really seen any improvement in the last 2 years in terms of what you've found in your testing. So what do you think needs to be done so that if we see another report from Vermont Legal Aid in 2016, it looks different?
Well, I think one thing that people aren't always aware of is that some discrimination comes from unconscious or semi-unconscious bias. So a big problem that landlords have is that they're making decisions based on what they call their gut. So I feel like this person fits, or I feel like this person doesn't fit. The problem with doing that is that our gut, anybody's, is riddled with bias. So I might feel more comfortable calling back Joe Smith than I do calling back Juan Hernandez. And that's not necessarily because I consciously and intentionally want to not rent to someone who's Hispanic. It is because I, as a white person, and most people in Vermont, and therefore most landlords in Vermont are white, have our own bias having grown up in a segregated community. So I think what can people do? I think landlords should be very aware of acting on their unconscious gut response rather than the objective facts of the application. And I think in order to do that, landlords and everybody needs to really get some training and thinking about how to undo some of that unconscious bias that we all carry around.
That's Rachel Batterson. She's the Housing Discrimination Law Project Director for Vermont Legal Aid, and she's been giving us the details of her organization's new report on rental discrimination in Vermont. Rachel, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, if you have faced discrimination or think you may have, or if you have questions about what your rights and responsibilities are as a landlord, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts and experiences on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And we're joined now by Ted Wimpey, Fair Housing Project Director for Champlain Valley Office of Economic Opportunity, CVOEO, and Angela Zykowski, owner of the Vermont Apartment Owners Association. Welcome to the program to both of you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
So let's just go back to this report that we just heard about from Rachel Batterson first, and I'd love to hear from both of you if the results surprise you and if you think they're accurate. Ted, you first.
I would say the results do not surprise me that much because, as you mentioned, they are consistent with previous study and with studies that our agency has conducted in the past, the last one being 2004. I think it will surprise a lot of people because we think of Vermont as being more discrimination-free. But I think it's a heads up that, you know, that it still exists. One can, you know, quabble about these kind of tests. They meet HUD standards. Our tests had to meet HUD standards because HUD funds them. So there's consistency across the country when HUD funds these. If you look at the rest of the country, does not diverge that much from other places in the country where tests are done. However, I think we do need to hold Vermont to a higher standard, and we all want to.
Angela, what about your perspective?
I would say one of the things I would like to point out is we keep throwing out these percentages, and these percentages seem very high. But what that percentage is made up of is two specific categories that have been identified in this report. The first one is where basically overt discrimination has occurred. There's no question that it has happened. And I think that's the category that we need to be the most concerned about here. The other category that's getting thrown in with these large percentages is what's referred to as control test or favored. And what that has done is shown that the experience indicates favoritism to the control tester, but the reason for the differing treatment is not definitive. So the study's not even going as far as to say it's a discriminatory reason, but yet it's getting lumped in with the discrimination numbers. So I think the number may be being presented a little higher than it actually is.
So what are you saying there, though, that we don't need to be concerned even if the number is lower? Or, I mean, if it's unclear, shouldn't we still be concerned because it's unclear and perhaps there's some unconscious or semi-conscious bias going on?
I think it shows that there's definitely a need for some outreach and for some education. And I don't think you can ever have too much of that. I mean, look, we have to have a click it or ticket campaign almost every year to remind people to wear their seatbelts. And I think most of us would say that's a pretty basic thing when you get in your car, but yet we still need reminders about it. So this is a good opportunity for us all to be reminded about this topic and to have a discussion about what landlords can do to help maybe reduce these numbers.
We're talking today about rental discrimination. We're looking at it from a couple different angles, and we'd love to hear again from listeners about your experiences. And you can call 1-800-639-2211 to share yours or to ask a question. We're also hoping to hear from landlords about how you deal with this with your own units, how you think about how you want to rent to people, how maybe you try to keep your own unconscious biases in check when you're doing rental units. Our number again, 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Matt, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share a story of something I experienced. I was getting advice from a landlord. I was considering buying a rental unit as an investment, and he was telling me how one of his female tenants didn't pay rent and how he was evicting her. And he said he's no longer going to rent to women unless they're married. And I was just blown away. I was like, I cannot believe you're, one, discriminating like that, and two, telling me about it. I was like, that's clearly illegal. And, you know, I wasn't going to do anything about it, but I was just pretty shocked.
So did you invest in that apartment building?
No, it was just a landlord who owned some units.
Hmm.
And he was just giving me advice, like, don't rent to women unless they're married. And I was like, what is this, the 1920s or something?
Yeah, Matt, thanks for your call. Appreciate hearing from that. Ted, do you see that kind of gender discrimination happening in Vermont?
Well, I should explain right off that currently we work more on issues of the systemic fair housing problems, that is, exclusive zoning and the kind of things that prevent the development of affordable housing, which would include opportunities for more protected classes under fair housing law. However, we do keep abreast of the kind of problems. I've never quite heard one that flagrant when it comes to discrimination based both on gender and on marital status, which are the marital status is the state category, and the gender protection is federal and state. It's interesting to hear that kind of blatant discrimination. And that tells me that kind of problem really needs, I agree with Angela that education is very important, and I could see us, you know, working on education together for property owners, and we'll continue to reach out to renters and prospective purchasers of housing to educate them. But for that kind of flagrant discrimination, it just shows there needs to continue to be testing, and there needs to continue to be good enforcement.
For landlords, Angela, what happens when a landlord says, look, this is my unit, I want to be able to rent to people who I believe I can trust, and I do need to trust my gut? I mean, how do you talk with landlords about, look, here's what you can do legally and here's what you can't do?
Well, there is. Landlords are able to use an application process, and they should. It's a good idea to have a written application. That way you're treating every applicant exactly the same. You're collecting the same information. You're following up in the same fashion. Landlords have the ability to call prior landlord references. They have the ability to run credit checks. They have the ability to do criminal checks. So these are all things that can help landlords make an objective determination about whether somebody is a good candidate for a rental or not. I would say, going back to the situation that Matt described, it wouldn't surprise me if that landlord who made that comment was right in the middle of a court eviction process and was experiencing the extremely frustrating fashion of having to not only not have your rent come in, but then having to pay out money for lawyers and court costs and things. And it very potentially could have been a heat of the moment sort of comment that hopefully he was not acting on in the future, making decisions about future renters based on experience with one.
Although renter. What he said was, I'll never rent to women again, single women again.
Right.
Well, you know, on that note, we got a note from somebody who posted as TT Jr., who says, look, only rent to those who have a history of paying, then weed out those who can't spell on their applications, then look at the car they drive. Common sense will tell you who to rent to. How would you respond to that person? I don't know if that person's a landlord or not, but
those are all objective criteria. I don't necessarily maybe the type of car that they drive, but do they have a history of paying their rent on time from prior rentals? If they haven't paid in the past, chances are they're probably not going to pay in the future. And that's a very legitimate, objective reason to not rent to somebody.
But the car you drive, can you use that as a criteria?
I think it's very important that people understand not only what you can't do under fair housing law, but what you can do. And I actually use that as an example a lot of times when I'm trying to explain the difference between what's included in fair housing protections and what isn't. And a landlord could refuse to rent somebody because of the type car they drive. Maybe they don't like Toyotas, you know. There's nothing in the law that says they could it's prohibited to refuse to rent to somebody who drives a Toyota.
That's not a protected class.
That's not a protected class. So there are a lot of things you can use, both rational and even irrational, as long as you're not discriminating based on one of the protected categories.
We did get a note in response that I want to read as well to that comment online. Jay Soul says, wait, look at the car they drive? Because people who drive old cars shouldn't be rented to? I drive a 15-year-old car with 200,000 miles on it, but I always pay my rent on time, even when I have trouble feeding myself. Just because I'm poor and I drive an old car doesn't mean I don't deserve housing. And let's go to Tyler, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Tyler. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? My question was this. If you own a property, why is it that you cannot just plain out pick who you want to live in your property that is yours?
Let me pick up on that. So in case you couldn't hear Tyler's line because it was a little fuzzy, Tyler says, if you own a property, why can't you just decide who gets to live there? Why isn't it 100% your choice? Ted, maybe you could start us off.
Well, up until 1986 in this country, any kind of discrimination was permissible in housing. In 1964, 4 years previously, other protections for people who are African American or other nationalities, et cetera, were enacted in terms of public accommodations and so forth. But the protections under housing, fair housing law, were more controversial. And it was only after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated and cities went up in flames that finally enough people in Congress said, okay, we do have to do something. We've got extreme segregation. It's not only is it morally wrong, but it's causing problems for our country. We have to begin to address this issue. And that's when fair housing law was passed, just a few weeks after Martin Luther King's assassination, actually. So the point is that, and I should say there are exceptions for in the state of Vermont for and nationally, it gets complicated to get into details, but for people who live in housing, are a member of their immediate family in a building with three or fewer units, they cannot use discrimination in advertising, but they can. They're not subject to the regular fair housing law in terms of who they rent to. However, it's very important that we maintain, create those opportunities for people that historically have been excluded, and the kind of social problems that creates in segregation and just injustice in the country.
We're talking today about rental discrimination in Vermont. And listeners, if you have a thought or an experience you'd like to share, you can post it at vpr.net or you can call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Ted Wimpey is Fair Housing Project Director of the Champlain Valley Office of Economic Opportunity. Angela Zykowski is owner of the Vermont Apartment Owners Association, and they are both with us today talking about rental discrimination in Vermont's housing market. We're also hearing from many of you. You can post your thoughts or experiences and continue the conversation at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Or you can call 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from a frustrated landlord who posted, "To reduce rental discrimination, some system must be put in place so landlords can remove tenants easily for violation of leases. Currently, the law is so heavily favoring the tenant that it takes almost 6 months and thousands of dollars to evict a tenant who stops paying rent." And Charlie says the rental market is just cutthroat, which makes this that much worse. Not that it directly addresses discrimination, but we need more affordable in-village housing for people, especially in places like Montpelier. Burlington could use more too, of course. The thing is, the population isn't increasing that fast, but people are moving to the population centers. Some discrimination may be inadvertent because of associations between disadvantaged groups and poverty. Of course, some people are just bigoted, and that's the hardest to change. So a lot there, but Angela, let me go to you with these questions. Frustrated landlord saying, look, it's hard to be a landlord, and it can be very hard to evict people. And Charlie saying, the rental market is cutthroat, it's very tight, and that makes this worse. And in fact, that has been found in these studies that where the market is tight, there often is more discrimination.
It is hard to be a landlord in Vermont. There are a lot of regulations that you have to pay attention to. Discrimination is just one of them. In terms of evicting a tenant for non-payment of rent, I think the biggest advice I can give to landlords is you need to act on it quickly. Don't wait. Don't wait to send the notice. Don't wait to start the court action. The longer you delay, it's not going to get the better situation. It's just going to make you feel like it's taking forever. Most of the courts are processing these cases as quickly as they can. But yes, even in the best case scenario, it can take 2 to 3 months to get a non-paying tenant out.
How do you think that then contributes to discrimination, which is what this listener was saying?
I think it's an indirect contributor. So landlords then feel like they need to be more choosy. And we may go back to Matt's comment from the landlord he was talking to who had to evict a single woman who was not paying her rent. And then it makes him a little gun shy about potentially renting to another single woman because he's had to go through this process. So it creates a situation where another deserving person in that class may be denied an apartment based on the landlord's prior experience.
Let's go to Helena calling in from Hardwick. Hi, Helena. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm a renter and I'm also disabled. And I had an experience where a landlord, they asked me what I did for a living. And when I explained that I was disabled and I didn't work, the landlord said that she basically wouldn't rent to me because a disabled person spends more time in the unit and the wear and tear is greater because I'm not at work most of the day.
Hmm.
And she, from her perspective, she seemed very, she felt very entitled to have this, you know, opinion and this method of weeding out potential tenants.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that experience with us. A good example there of some of what we've been talking about and a really clear example from a person who's experienced it. So I appreciate that. Let's get another call in while we have the time here. Dave's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. So I was really happy when I heard one of the people on your panel say that, you know, working toward giving people who historically experienced injustice opportunities. But I think, like, when you have tenants that, as you said, were just plain old ignorant enough to be picketed, you can't put it by them to be savvy enough to hide that. I mean, you know, so even when you have all these great apparatus to ensure that there's a less likelihood that people are going to, landlords that are going to be prejudiced, you know, towards various groups, I think you also have to work at it from another angle as well. And, you know, I think maybe creating more opportunities for tenants to organize themselves, to run their own show in a somewhat collective fashion. Choose the people who they're going to live with in the same kind of building, you know, give them more power as opposed to having, like, you know, a subsidized housing where there's one landlord responsible for all of this. Might be a additional approach to consider.
Yeah, Dave, thanks for your call. Your line's a little good, so I'm gonna, a little bad, rather, so I'm going to stop you there. But I think we got what you're saying, and I appreciate hearing that. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, Dave is mentioning, you know, renters and landlords, and maybe renters can get together and it sounds like maybe try to think about who else is in the units, but also maybe getting together collectively is not always a bad thing for renters anyway. But let's take the time we have left to talk a little bit about how to approach this problem, which you've both acknowledged exists to whatever degree it exists. How do you think, Ted Wimpey, we need to deal with discrimination and perhaps discrimination that's often unintentional?
That's a very good question. And one of the messages that you read from someone talking about the creating more opportunities near centers of towns was a good segue to something I wanted to make a point that there's fair housing where discrimination happens against individuals that are protected. A blatant example would be that telling someone with a disability, I don't rent to people with disabilities for any reason. But there's also a kind of a disparate impact when it comes to affordability of housing and the fact that people who need to, say, work in town or shop in town have to live far out because there's not enough affordable housing near their downtowns. So some of that is something under the control of municipalities. In order to create more inclusive communities, we need to make sure that municipalities do not have excessive lot size requirements, for instance, that they have inducements for building appropriate level of density, and because the housing is more affordable when you can build at a denser level and have people closer to where they need to work and shop.
Angela, what about for you? You mentioned earlier that you think education is key, educating landlords on what they can and cannot do, what the rules are. What else?
I mean, I think that's a big one. Sometimes one-to-one workshops, we try to outreach and we're happy to take calls from landlords, whether they're members or not of the association, because we believe that an educated landlord population is a better landlord population. So if somebody has a question, I don't know, can I say this? Can I do this? Please call us. We're happy to talk with you about it.
And we're going to put some links up at vpr.net to both of your organizations and to the report that we were talking about earlier in the program, looking at discrimination in the rental markets in Vermont. Angela Zykowski is the owner of the Vermont Apartment Owners Association. Thanks very much, Angela.
Thank you for having me.
Ted Wimpey is the Fair Housing Project Director for the Champlain Valley Office of Economic Opportunity. Thanks very much, Ted.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, one Vermont man is being honored this weekend at New York City's Pride March for work he did to organize the original Pride March in 1970. But first, we'll hear from Peter Galbraith, who's in Iraq right now advising Kurdish leaders. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Peter Galbraith of Townsend has spent much of the last 30 years working closely with Kurds in northern Iraq as that region has tried to create a path to independence from the rest of the country. Galbraith is in Kurdistan right now, and yesterday our managing producer Patty Daniels spoke with him about how the situation in Iraq looks to the Kurdish leaders he's advising.
You're just in Iraq for a short time right now. What are you hoping to accomplish in the time that you're there?
It really is a process of having discussions with the leaders about how they're going to face the new situation in Iraq. President Barzani met this week with Secretary of State John Kerry, and he told him that that there's a new reality in Iraq, as indeed there is. The Iraqi army has disappeared. Of the 17 army divisions, 15 of them have been destroyed. The Sunni areas of the country are almost entirely under the control of Sunni rebels led by ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, which is very much an extremist terrorist group. He points out that Kurdistan now has 1,050 kilometers of border with ISIS and just 15 kilometers with the rest of Iraq. Well, obviously, that leads them to have to think about what is their future. All the people of Kurdistan want to have an independent country. And, you know, if Iraq has been unable to assist in the defense of Kurdistan, there is no Iraqi army, so they have to defend their own territory with their own military. the crisis has made them an independent state, and so now they're contemplating the next step. President Barzani has talked about holding a referendum on independence, and I think that will likely take place in the next 6 months or so.
You mentioned that region as an independent state, and there had been a lot of talk in the mid-2000s about a partition of Iraq. What perspective do you have on that now compared to 8 years ago?
Well, I will say that I wrote a book about that called The End of Iraq, which argued in 2006 that Iraq had broken up and that the United States should not be in the business of trying to put it back together. So today, the divisions of the country, I think, are very stark. And I think there's no prospect of building a unified Iraq. And so one, I think, rightly should accept the reality. The world is not worse off for having some states disappear. I don't think very many people miss the Soviet Union, and not very many people miss Yugoslavia. What we regret about the breakup of Yugoslavia was the violence, not the breakup.
And so what would a broken up Iraq look like? What would its constituent parts become?
Well, certainly there would be Kurdistan along the border with Turkey and Iran, that is to say in the northeast part of the country. The Kurds are ethnically a different people from the Arabs, and Kurdistan has been out of Iraq de facto since the 1991 uprising at the end of the first Gulf War. Sunnis and Shiites, both of them would say that they are Iraqi, but they don't have any common idea of what it is to be Iraqi. The Shiites, who are the majority, were oppressed throughout the history of Iraq until the American invasion in 2003 brought them to power. They now feel, because they are the majority, that it's their right to rule Iraq. They have adopted fairly repressive policies toward the Sunnis, and this has provoked the Sunni rebellion. And for the Sunni regions, it's not just Iraq, but it is the whole eastern part of Syria. And ISIS, as one can tell from the name, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, basically is looking to erase the boundary, which was an utterly artificial boundary drawn at the end of the First World War. So in redrawing the map, it's not just the map of Iraq that's in the process of being withdrawn. It's the map of Iraq and Syria, and it may spill over to other parts of the Middle East as well.
Would we be at this moment in history if it weren't for the Syrian conflict? Is that where ISIS has sprung from?
The breakup of Iraq, the fact that the Kurdistan wanted out, the fact that the Sunnis and Shiites didn't have a shared idea of what Iraq should be, that was an underlying condition. But what the war in Syria has done is to create a Sunni militant force, which has attracted a lot of recruits. So yes, the Syrian conflict is the reason that ISIS has been able to take over so much of Iraq.
On Tuesday evening, you wrote us that you had dinner with Ahmed Chalabi, one of the leading candidates to replace Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. What is your read on Maliki's future and who should replace him?
Of course, it's for the Iraqis to decide who should replace Maliki. But he has no support among the Kurds and the Sunnis, who are perhaps 40% of the members of the Iraqi parliament, and there are many Shiites who are disaffected with him as well. There are three or four candidates to replace him, some from Maliki's own Dawa party. That is unacceptable to the Kurds and to the Sunnis. Ahmed Chalabi, who I think many in Vermont will remember as the person who persuaded the Bush administration to invade Iraq and, you know, presented all sorts of evidence that turned out not to be true of weapons of mass destruction. He is a leading candidate, and I think actually he probably would be the best candidate. That may surprise some people listening to me, but he came to the U.S. He had no political support, and he got the U.S. to loan him our army and to spend $1.5 trillion in pursuit of his objectives. Now, from an Iraqi perspective, that demonstrates that he's a very effective Iraqi. And the fault of Americans shouldn't be angry at him for getting the U.S. to pursue his foreign policy objectives. They should be angry at the people in Washington who simply believed on face value what he was saying. But he's a very hard worker. He's very smart, as evidenced by the fact that he did get the U.S. to invade Iraq.
So put this moment right now in context for people here. How critical of a turning point is this in the last 10 to 15 years of Iraqi history?
This is a moment in Iraqi history of equal importance to the invasion in 2003. It is changing the order of the country. And now you see the Sunnis coming in, taking their own territory, threatening Baghdad. Most people don't think they could take it, but they don't rule it out. And you see the dissolving of the border between Iraq and Syria. In some ways, to take a longer historical perspective, in 1991 in Europe, we saw the end of the World War I settlement in Europe. So the countries that were created at the end of World War I, Yugoslavia, the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia, disappeared. And now in the Middle East, we're seeing, I think, the dissolution of Iraq and Syria, and it's not clear how much further this will spread.
Peter Galbraith, thank you for your time. I hope that you continue to travel safely there.
Well, thank you, and it's very good talking to you back in Vermont.
Peter Galbraith is a state senator from Townsend. He spoke with our managing producer, Patty Daniels, yesterday. Galbraith is in Iraq as an advisor to Kurdish leaders, and his 2006 book is called The End of Iraq: How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. Forty-five years ago this weekend, New York City police officers conducted an early morning raid of a bar called the Stonewall Inn, known to be patronized by gays and lesbians. That was common practice by police in those days, but this time the patrons pushed back and a riot erupted. A year later, the first gay pride parade wound through the streets of New York as a commemoration of the Stonewall riots. One of the organizers of that first march was New Haven resident Fred Sargent. He's being honored at this weekend's Pride Parade in New York City. When I spoke with Sargent yesterday, I asked him to take us back to the events leading up to the first Pride March that he worked to organize. He said there had been protests and marches for gay rights before Stonewall, but they were too quiet.
The demonstrations were very polite. People went in business attire and in a sense, tended to be invisible. You know, the demonstration that we were planning on attending just after Stonewall was what was called the annual reminder in Philadelphia. My partner then, Craig Rodwell, he had proposed and organized the first reminder in 1965 and had been disappointed with how the organized groups had changed what was to be a visible demonstration into something that, aside from the picket signs, you really didn't know who we were or what we were about. That was to be my first picket line, and in the end, I ended up not going because we had a bookshop in the village that was the first shop in the country devoted to literature and activism, and we ended up having to keep the shop open after the riots, and Craig went on down to Philadelphia, but he returned saying that was the last reminder, and the next demonstration would be in New York, and we would form something around a commemoration of the Stonewall riots.
And when you say that the protests were too mild in some way, remind us what you were protesting at the time.
Well, we were protesting regarding treatment of gays and lesbians at the time. People could be fired from their job, often were. They could lose their housing, and certainly having a relationship was much more difficult then than it is, of course, today.
So now let's talk about the first Gay Pride March in New York in 1970. This wasn't a reminder. This was something else altogether.
We intentionally dropped the dress code for the demonstration simply because we thought it stifled expression, and the Pride marches since then have, in fact, done everything they can to increase expression, and I think that's had an amazingly positive impact on visibility and people getting to know the fact that their friends and neighbors and people who they come into contact with on an everyday basis are in fact gays or lesbians.
Yeah, and we have a picture we're putting up on our website that you've given us of you standing with a bullhorn at the front of the parade in the first Gay Pride March. What was the feeling like? What was the atmosphere like?
Well, we had no idea that day how many people were going to show up. First of all, we talked to the police at length about our permitting process, and they withheld the permit until the morning of the march. And we just simply told them, well, we expect thousands. And as it turned out, we got a lot more than we expected. There were tens of thousands eventually that marched along the route.
Was it exciting?
Quite to actually see something that you'd worked that almost a year on come to fruition like that was certainly something that I'll always remember.
Was there any fear? I mean, part of the issue at the time was in relation to how police were treating gays and lesbians in New York City. So was there any fear during that first march?
Well, we had tried to address that. One of the problems that we were concerned might present itself was that a commemoration of a riot might become a riot. And that was the reason why we started at the Stonewall and walked away from the location up to Central Park. The police turned out to be very good about their role in the march, and I certainly had no complaints about what they did that day.
Fred, what kind of influence did that organizing and that particular march have on the rest of your life?
Well, I went on to become a police officer in the city of Stamford, and so it's always had an impact and does to this day.
Was your decision to become a police officer directly related to what you saw police officers doing to gays and lesbian people in New York City at that time?
Sure, more than a little. I felt that the job could be done in a better way, and I think we've seen that it has. The policing has made such progress in its way of dealing with diverse communities, whether here in Vermont or in New York or in Connecticut. And I think that's something we can all be proud of.
So that, I guess, leads to the question of what's still left? You know, we've seen so many states now turning in favor of gay marriage. As you said, there's a different attitude by and large, in policing, in terms of how police deal with different kinds of populations. So for you, where does the activism go now?
Well, I think there still remains a lot to be done. The marriage issue is certainly not settled yet. This will probably work its way to the Supreme Court at this point. The situation around the world, in fact, is deteriorating, so I don't think there's going to be any let-up for activism in the foreseeable future.
And do you see pride marches and pride parades around the country and around the world as contributing in any way to that activism, or is it something else?
The pride marches will contribute, as they have in the past, in creating visibility for the gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender community, and we're just going to need more of them as some people seem to retrench in their disregard for the gay community.
How are you being honored and recognized in this Pride March in New York City this weekend?
Well, it's been a little chaotic. Things have been up in the air since the very beginning, and I've only just learned that as part of the march structure, I'm asked to be at the head of the march, just behind the color guard that they're having for the first time this year, which will be the Boy Scouts of the Greater New York Council. They're appearing in the march in direct defiance of the national organization's prohibition of scouts in uniform marching in such events.
So you're going to be behind the color guard.
Yeah.
And marching sort of in the same position that you were, in a sense, in 1970?
Sort of in the same position, but then again, I'm probably going to be in a golf cart. I'm not in any shape to make that march again.
Well, Fred, I hope the march and the parade goes very well this weekend. Thank you so much for speaking with me about your role in the first Pride March in 1970 and what's going to happen this weekend in New York City.
Thank you, Jen.
Fred Sargent is a retired police lieutenant from Stamford, Connecticut, who now lives in New Haven, Vermont. He is the partner of VPR Senior Vice President John Van Hoosen. That'll do it for today's show. We're still getting comments on our earlier discussion about rental discrimination. Gabby in Waterbury says, look, Vermont tenants have more rights than they realize. Discrimination, however, is alive and well. Our last property manager admitted to us that he turned down a tenant because of her children. Listeners, you can share your thoughts or experiences and join the discussion on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Tomorrow on the program, Bob Kinzel will be talking about the top challenges facing the Department of Fish and Wildlife, including how to encourage more people to hunt, trap, and fish in the face of declining revenues from hunting and fishing licenses. Share your thoughts for Commissioner Lewis Porter and Wildlife Director Mark Scott by writing to Vermont Edition at vpr.net, and then tune in tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.